I'm here in Lisnisky, and I'm in the office of Frank McManus. And Frank, you're a solicitor here for many years now. But let's go back and talk about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the parish of Kinnolly, which is dissected by the border. And I actually, because of the rules at that time, we, even though we lived in Fermanagh, we were allowed to play juvenile football in County Cavan. And during my time as a juvenile footballer, I came into contact with a man who went on to become the parish priest of Derry Lynn, Father Fintan McKernan. After that, I became a teacher. By profession, I was a teacher. And then I became a Member of Parliament. And unfortunately, I lost my seat as a Member of Parliament. And a former teacher and a former Member of Parliament isn't good for very much. I tried to go back to teaching, but the Bishop of Clogher, my former headmaster, Bishop Mulligan, let it be known that I was not to be employed in the Catholic school system. And there wasn't a hope of me being employed in the Protestant school system. So I couldn't go back to teaching. So I had to do something else. And I decided to become a lawyer.
I see. Well, with that kind of background, your father, was he farming?
Oh, no, he was a small... We were born... It was 10 of us born and reared, dragged up on a small farm of 22 and a half acres in a town, the townland of Clonliffe. In the summertime, it would grow good grass, a lot of it. But in the wintertime, it would be, you know, tend to be very wet land. We were never hungry, it's not an Angela's Ashes story now. I have no bad memories at all. The best of memories. I was brought up reasonably well in very difficult circumstances.
Extraordinary. So there was 10 of.
There was 10 of us. Yes.
Oh, where did you fit in?
I'm third youngest.
I see.
I'm wedged in between two priests. My older brother's Father Jim McManus, and my younger brother's better known, modest kind of a man, fella called Father Sean McManus, who doesn't, advertise very much. He's in Washington, D.C. He's younger than I am. And then the youngest of the family will be 70 in February. He's called Miles. He lives in London. I'm the only one now living in Ireland.
So growing up in the 40s and 50s, life was normal
it was, except that at quite an early age, you became aware of the fact that you were a Catholic, and that carried certain disadvantages. And that you didn't want, when you reached the use of reason, 7 or 8 or 9 years, you became quite aware of that. And for example, our lane, the Clonliffe Lane, wasn't tarred until the 70s. Electricity wasn't installed until the 60s. We didn't have electricity until the mid 60s, and those were just facts. Were just facts of life.
Yeah, and it made life, I suppose, much more difficult then to get on and to achieve.
It did.
But when it came to the troubles, tell me...
Fortunately, you see, the 1947 Education Act was passed, which which was the biggest blow to unionist domination in the North, that single greatest factor, because a whole lot of uppity Catholics then passed the 11 plus, and they went on to secondary school, and they went on to university, and they caused a whole lot of bother by looking for, things like civil rights, shocking sort of carry on to be at. And I became mixed up in all of that at an early age, because, I came from a political family anyway. On my mother's side, there would be big into politics.
Was your mother's maiden name?
My mother's maiden name was Mullen, or MacMullen.
And where did she come from?
She came from the top of the mountain up at Cairn, which is on the borders of Derry Lynn and Kinnolly. Her people came originally from outside Lisnisky, but they fell out with the Orangemen and were chased to Carn Mountain, literally on the top of the mountain. And that's where she was born and reared. My father, I never was conscious of him being much mixed up in politics. He had been a member of a... He was a drummer in a band at one stage. Yeah. But my father was 47 when he married, and my mother was 23, so there was a very, very big age gap. And I never remember him much except as a, you know, as an older, as quite an old man, you know.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary when you think about it in a way. My grandfather, which is only two generations away, my grandfather was alive at the time of the famine.
Imagine, it was my, only two.
That's two only two generations back.
My goodness.
Because my father was born in 1877.
Yeah.
Which was 30 years after the famine,
yeah.
And his father would have been only 30 at yeah. that time, so he was alive, not very old, but alive at the time of the famine. Which, and it's there's not that many people can say that.
I know,
and it's because of the huge gap in age between my father and my mother.
And just on a side, any stories trickled on from the famine told by your grandfather?
No. And I thought actually, as a young, for quite some time, I thought it was because of the age gap that possibly was one of those arranged marriages. But no, it wasn't. It was a romantic marriage.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was able to check that out.
Yeah.
Enough people to satisfy me that it was true, that what my mother told me was true, that her parents weren't all that keen on... he was a respectable man, they knew that, but he was much older than her. Anyway, it worked out the best.
But you were saying that it was difficult to get on, I said, and you said you made the effort and you went on and you made sure you got a good education.
I was the first Catholic from the parish of Kinnaly to get a university degree.
Were you? Indeed.
Yes, the very first. Yeah. Dr. Curran, but that's a degree in Northern Ireland. Dr. Kevin Curran, he became a doctor. He was from Kinnaly, but his degree came from the south.
Yeah.
I was the first Catholic in the parish of Kinnaly to get a degree in Northern Ireland.
Imagine.
Now, and that was in 1964 or
thereabouts. But bring me back to around that time, and you know, you had the civil rights marches and you had Bloody Sunday. Wait, did you go up and march, or did any brothers?
Yes, of course. I became vice chairman of the Fermanagh Civil Rights Association, and we published booklets and we marched, and I was sent to jail for it, and for marching when I shouldn't be marching. Oh, of course. Yeah. Oh, it's a badge of honour. Of course it is. What else would you, as the fellow said, what else would you be doing in those days?
Yeah.
The civil rights movement lit a spark that was very difficult to quench. And of course, if the unionists had to have brains and give the civil rights people what they were asked, extraordinary stuff, like one man, one vote.
Mm.
I mean, how the hell could you object to that?
So you saw a need then to do something about it, and then, and to go out and to march and to protest and that.
Uh-huh.
And did you get involved yourself then in any organisation, or would you have thought about it, or did you?
No. Yeah. I didn't. First of all, my oldest brother, Patrick, was involved in the border campaign of the 63, and he was killed in a bomb explosion.
How was he killed?
He was killed a bomb. He was transporting or handling a bomb, and it went off prematurely, and he was blown to pieces. And I was 15 or 16 at the time, you know, and that had a major influence on me. And it kind of, instead of propelling me on, it kind of did the opposite. And all through my time in Queens, took hardly any interest in politics. I was far more interested in things that university students do, you know, running after women maybe I never took a drink until I was 21, but I made up for it later on. I kept my confirmation pledge to 21.
But then when your brother sadly was blown up, that changed things.
Oh,
did
oh change things for the family, because he left home in December 56, and of course our house then became a target for constant police attention. You know, the house was raided on at least a weekly basis. They would come in and they'd search everything in.
And was there a reason for that? I mean, were there other siblings of yours?
No. But everybody, they knew perfectly well. The story was that he had gone to visit my uncle in Athlone on a fishing holiday, and the troubles broke out, and he was afraid to come back. Which was a holding story. It was good enough. But the problem was nobody believed, you know, the B-men and the police didn't believe it.
So
naturally enough, they didn't believe it, because they would have known perfectly well, because they would have had their sources. I mean, I remember my father saying to him that night, the last thing he said to him was, you'll not be at the end of the road until the police know what you're at, you know. And he was probably quite right.
And what was his mission that evening?
He told us that he was going, and away he went the next day. And I never seen him after that. Never seen him once after that. He used to meet my mother in a safe house in Swanlinbar, but but he was a very religious type of fella, because he warned my mother once that to watch out for me, because I had a notion of girls, and she would need to keep an eye on me. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know where he got that information, but there you are.
But you would say a lot of the influence came from your mother.
Though. Oh, that's right. Oh, definitely. Definitely from my mother's side. Yes.
Imagine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so. But then you went on into politics yourself, talk to me about that part of your life.
Well, the Fermanagh South Tyrone is very finely balanced. Always has been a finely balanced, and it was very finely balanced at that time in 1970, and a very worthy man called Dr. McCluskey from Dungannon started what was called the McCluskey Circus. He organised a meeting. He was the campaign for justice in Northern Ireland. He was a very, very... He did an enormous amount of good work, him and his wife. And there's a summer school run by his daughter over in... what do you call the town over on the Cooley Peninsula? I can't think of the town now. But anyway, but it's always on the weekend of an All-Ireland semi-final, which is very bad. And, you know, there's no contest between whether you're going to go to a summer school or go to the All-Ireland semi-final. I would love to go to it, but I always go to the All-Ireland semi-final. So, anyway, he set up this thing called McCluskey Circus. He organised, or several people organised, local meetings. And people were invited to put themselves forward to see could an agreed candidate be achieved for Fermanagh South Tyrone. Because prior to that, the Nationalists and the Republicans had, you know, put up candidates, each had put up, with the results that, you know, nobody ever won. Well, that's not true. Phil Clark won. He was involved in the 56 border campaign too, but he was a felon, so he was in jail, so he couldn't take his seat. He won the election, but it was the Brits said, "Oh no, we can't have that." So anyway, I came out of that process. I went round the country advertising my wares, and enough people listened to me, and I became the unity candidate for Fermanagh South Tyrone, and I won. It was a very, very tight contest, and for a long time, I think it may still be in the Guinness Book of Records.
Who was campaigning against you?
Oh, the Marquess of Hamilton, now the Duke of Abercorn.
Yes,
he had a few bob, not like me, but he was a decent. Himself now was a decent sort of.
But you got great support around here.
I did. We won convincingly. Yeah, but narrowly, but convincingly, and then. In the meantime, then, the SDLP had been formed, And people suggested to me that I might join the SDLP, but no. My views would have been a bit too Republican for the SDLP. So I didn't join the SDLP. And when I was... Paddy Duffy of Dungannon was my election agent. And Paddy Duffy was a big member of the SDLP, but a really fine man, a great guy. And did an enormous amount of good. And every time I met him, I would say, Duffy, there's only one thing wrong with you. I don't want to hear that again. So I was at his funeral, and Paddy O'Hanlon, who was a prominent member of the SDLP, and I were walking up in the cortege to the graveyard, and he says, you know what the first item on the agenda in the early days of the SDLP were? I said, what's that, Paddy? What's that effort from Anna's out to Rowan up to now? So I was a bit of a thorn in the... side. So yeah. Much so that when that foolish man Heath took on the miners and had an election in February 74, Dennis Haughey of the SDLP opposed me, and Harry West was automatically elected. Then we got our own back a wee bit because Austin Currie was going to stand the next time. Mm-hmm. And we reached a compromise or a standoff. I said I would stand down if he did.
Yes.
And I said I would stand down in favour of Frank Maguire, who was from this town and was known to be a reasonable sort of a fella. And that worked, and Maguire did become the candidate. But he was the only election candidate as was ever elected without opening his mouth once. He never made a speech before the election or after the election.
Mm-hmm.
I did all the speaking for him, and he never spoke in Parliament. He attended, but he never spoke.
Yeah.
So, that's
a very strange arrangement. But anyway,
there you go.
But talk to me more about, say, right through the 70s and 80s, when you were so involved in politics, there was so many shootings and bombings and killings going on.
Yeah.
And right here where you were.
Absolutely. Oh, there was some very vicious stuff went on. And I was coming from a political meeting in Enniskillen, and obviously the guy was following me in the car, and I lived left off the Sligo Road, and I turned, and he was a very good shot. He had been a former paratrooper or something. Still lives in Enniskillen. And he went a little past me and then fired back, you know, when he got into line with me. Oh, and he hit the car and he hit me. If they ever give out medals, I'll have to put down my pants to prove that I got wounded. He nicked me here and he hit the house too.
Oh, why did he fire at you?
He wanted to kill me. That's why he fired at me.
I know, but why did he try to kill you then?
Because I was the the Republican Member of Parliament and he was a loyalist.
All right, and for but you weren't a terrorist. He didn't see you as a terrorist.
No, well, he did, of course, see me as a terrorist. Of course he seen me as a terrorist.
And so that particular occasion, I mean, you were an innocent victim.
I was a victim.
So what did you do about it? Did you bring him to court?
No, but I didn't know. I didn't know, and I couldn't prove it. He was never charged. But everybody knew. Now, don't ask me how they know these things, but they did. Two young men called at the house not that long afterwards, and one of them was the son of a man that Father Fintan would know quite well, but I'll not bother mentioning his name.
Was he a part-time UDR, or was he?
He wasn't part-time at that time. He had been in the UDR, but he had left it at that stage. He was the local. I think he was either I'm not sure whether it was UVF or UDA. I'm not sure which of the outfits he was in. One of those loyalist
organizations
or terrorist organization. Yeah.
And so, my goodness. And so, you were a target, and then did you feel your life was okay? It was certainly if he was trying to kill you that night, it must have put you.
But
really
What else would he have
been trying to do? From then on, were you completely alert?
No, I was. I developed. I've given it up now, but I still do it. I developed a constant habit of watching cars coming towards me, behind me, And I developed a memory, a tremendous memory for car registrations. And I remember, just to digress, when I became a solicitor, there was a police inspector in Enniskillen who fancied himself. He thought that he was, you know, Sherlock Holmes. And I used to meet him very, because he was prosecuted or the principal witness in cases that I was defending. And I hadn't seen him for a very long time. And I met him one day up at Crumlin Road Courthouse. And I had seen his car, you see, and I said to him, I said, are you still driving? I see you're still driving EAL so-and-so. How do you know my number? I said, oh, no, we're keeping an eye on you. I remembered it. I'd seen his number once, and it was in there, and I remember. I had hundreds of car registrations number in my head for years and years.
So, yes, and having that retention and understanding, but you were a constant threat to...
Obviously under threat, and you become quite careful after that. And, of course, ever since then, my car has been in a garage every night in my life. It's not allowed to be, because it was very stressful. And Carmel, she was at home all the time, you see, and I was out wandering about. And there was a very unpleasant person who, the minute I would leave, she would get these phone calls and there'd be heavy breathing and that sort of stuff. And it may not be connected, but I think it is. Yeah. There was a reserve policeman who was always on the street where we lived before I moved into my own.
Where were you living?
I was living in Belmore Street in Enniskillen, in a flat in Belmore Street while our house was being built.
Yeah.
And then the poor fellow was killed in a bomb explosion, and strangely enough, the telephone calls stopped. So there was a fair 2 and 2, probably made 4 in that case, you know. But I mean, that was not a good way to stop the phone calls, you know.
So indeed, yeah. So, but living in that kind of way where you couldn't trust your neighbour, you couldn't trust the person coming towards you in a car.
Yeah.
It must have made life very awkward for you.
Difficult. Yeah, it did. But I was lucky, I suppose, in that the personality that I had at that time, and still have. Yeah. I don't tend to, you know, I'm not a worrier.
But being a solicitor here in Enniskillen, do you look after people who were affected by the Troubles in any way?
Oh, yeah. Well, but that's all faded now. I mean, for a long time I was, you know, defended, you know, dozens of people who were on, you know, very serious.
They come to you because of your background?
Because it was well known, yeah, in background, yeah. And they thought, well, maybe that boy would take an interest in my case, you know. But they would have been exclusively now from the nationalist side, obviously. I didn't act for too many. There weren't too many UVF or UDA boys down here charged, you know, but they would probably not come to me anyway.
And in Enniskillen, you know, walking down, or not, but Lisniski here,
I'm
walking down.
I live in Enniskillen.
Yes, but do you feel...
Because
it's predominantly a Protestant community, isn't it?
No, not at all. Lisniski? Oh, God, not at all. No, not at 70, at least 70% Catholic.
Oh, do you? Oh, here? Yeah.
Oh, I am. Yeah. Fermanagh is, you know, substantially, has a substantial majority of nationalists. Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose it's important to understand, though, that your objective would be Sinn Féin. I'm sure you're a Sinn Féin supporter, are you?
No, I vote for Sinn Féin, but I never joined Sinn Féin. And the principal reason, and many people ask, Manus, with your views, why did you never join Sinn Féin? The answer is very simple. I took a decision a long time ago that I wouldn't join a political organisation that was controlled by another organisation. And everybody knows that Sinn Féin is controlled by another organisation over which nobody has control. So that was the principle. That is the reason why.
And how are you able to stick your head up then?
My rationale for not being more involved was quite simple. And I was challenged on it many times. And I said, no, I'll tell you what. I am not prepared to take up a gun myself and shoot somebody. And if that is so, then I am not entitled to encourage somebody else to do that, to do something that I am not prepared to do myself. a very simple, logical kind of an attitude to things.
Okay, but at the other hand, then you would support one of these people that would come to you looking for help if they.
Oh no, but in my job as a sister, that's a different thing altogether. That's a, you know, I support. You know, I don't do it now, but my sons do it. I mean, if you're accused of killing your next door neighbour, and you come to me, you get a full defence.
Of course, yeah.
But
you wouldn't be a sympathiser in any
way. Oh, not a minute. I mean, wouldn't be. I wouldn't say good man yourself for killing your neighbour. No, 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 no. But you do offer a full defence.
But I have to ask the question. So about your brother, who was steeped in it, and he managed to kill himself. I mean, would you have any? How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, I was very sad, of course.
Of course, as a young boy, your brother was killed. Yeah, yeah. But did you think that it was a waste of life, or did
No. No, of course it was a waste of a life. But, I mean, he was doing what he decided he should do, that he wanted to do. He wanted to fight to free, Ireland. And that was his chosen, he was a full-grown adult, and that's what he chose to do. And I would certainly not say that he was wrong in doing that. I wouldn't have had the courage to do it. But that doesn't mean to say that I would disapprove of him doing it. No, of course I wouldn't, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. No, it's interesting. And so, but you would have taught differently
what would you call me? A constitutional Republican, if there's... And like Fianna Fáil used to be called, slightly constitutional when they came in from the cold. Or Sinn Féin now are slightly constitutional. They have, to all intents and purposes, put away the gun somewhere or other. Whether they're still about or not, nobody knows. But they now say that they're... which creates an extraordinary situation for huge numbers of people who supported and who were part of the armed struggle. They now say, well, what was all this about?
Yeah.
Why did we do all that? So that a crowd of people would now get on their suits and, you know, swan about storm and doing damn all. And when you put it to, as I do provocatively, the occasional time when I know somebody who would have very strong views, and you say to them, well, why are you helping to administer the North now for and on behalf of the British government? What do you mean? And I said, well, you think of it now. You asked it. You contradict me. You show me why you are not administering Northern Ireland for and on behalf of the British government. You know, and most of them haven't the agility to get back at you. And then you say, look, I'm only kidding you. Instead of falling out of them, you say, but they go away thinking. And an awful lot of them see that now. This was, 30 years of war and countless deaths and so on. For what?
Yeah, it certainly left.
Luke Kelly had a song, "For What Died the Sons of Oisin."
But it certainly left an effect. I suppose in many cases, where families had bereavements because of the troubles,
it suffered
terribly. But you managed to escape all that, though. You managed not to get involved. Pick up a gun and shoot it.
No, because I decided that wasn't the way to go about the thing, you know. But I mean, an awful lot of people I know didn't agree with that view, you know.
Yeah. And would you agree with the fact that, say, your neighbour, your Ulster Protestant, who is a farmer by the day and then he wears a uniform at night and he becomes part-time UDR. How would you see that? Do you agree with do you think he's right to do that to protect his own property and his wife?
That's his view. But I mean, if you take up if you put on a uniform or a black beret or whatever it was and take up a gun, you're making a declaration to all and sundry that you are going to shoot somebody who opposes
you. If he's acting as a policeman,
that's the problem. You're forgetting now. You've wandered away from the central point. He's not act. He's not acting as a policeman. He's acting in defence of the state of Northern Ireland.
But he's protecting his rights.
No. He's protecting what he perceives to be his rights, which the almost 40% of the population would say, no, that's not a right. That was something that you imposed on this godforsaken part of the country, or your bosses, you know, did 400 years ago, which is when you have to go back to the beginning.
Plantation, you know? Times, yeah.
Yes, the plantation. Yeah. You were obviously coming at this from a completely different, but you're from the South, and that's the attitude that the South has. That you see, the police force in Northern Ireland was never a normal police force, not like the Garda.
Yeah.
The policeman's first duty was to defend Northern Ireland, and anybody who objected to Northern Ireland was an enemy. Plain and simple.
Okay, but you're a citizen of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And so he's protecting you.
No, he's not. He never did. No, he didn't. No. His first loyalty was to Northern Ireland. And you would have difficulty finding a nationalist who would say that the RUC protected him and his. No, that wasn't their function. Their function was to keep an eye on me and the likes of me to make sure that I didn't succeed in making trouble for Northern Ireland. That was their function, not the function of a proper... They weren't, and for that reason, they were never a proper... They were never a police force.
Yeah.
They were a paramilitary force with a task to defend the border. Plain and simple. And I mean, the unionist politicians in Northern Ireland made no bones about it. They didn't pretend otherwise. They never pretended that there were anything other than that.
But these people surely would only fire or protect if they were threatened themselves. They wouldn't, for example, they wouldn't come to your house and cause problems.
But they did in many cases. I mean, the instances of collusion are only now falling out of the woodwork. And over the next 10 years, there'll be a constant succession of collusion. It was rife all over. Jim Murphy and Louis Leonard, cases in point.
Well, his brother Jack would say that Jim was a great supporter of yours.
He was.
And canvassed for you.
Certainly he did.
Believed
in
what you were doing.
And so did Jack.
Yeah.
And Jim Cassidy provided the lorry every time we had a civil rights meeting in Enniskillen or anywhere else, and there was need for a platform. Jim Cassidy's lorry was there, and Jack Murphy drove it. Oh yes,
yeah.
And Jim Murphy. We published a small newspaper at one time, Erin Sense, and Jim Murphy picked it up in Cavan every evening and brought it down for distribution.
Oh,
he was a terrific fellow. He was a next door neighbour, and I knew him from...
You were neighbours, of course.
I knew him from us that height, yeah.
And his death then, I mean, that was another tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And do you think the police bothered themselves to investigate it?
No, because it was a reprisal, surely. For was it? They say it was a reprisal because your school teacher in Timor was shot and killed, Sanders.
And that justified it. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, was it? Do you think it was a reprisal?
He was a known. You see, Jim had been arrested. Jim had actually been arrested in the 56th time to him and his neighbour, Harry Martin, who's a brother of John Martin's. They were involved in the 56 campaign. And there would be marked men. You said, "Oh, they're still what they were then." You see, so, of course, nobody should have been killed. I mean, that's why I didn't take up a gun. I didn't decide to. I decided that I wouldn't go that way.
No, but you
the one to, the yes, one who might have gone that way, fortunately, went away to America. Sean, my brother Sean, he was a bit of a hothead.
Was he the man that became a priest? Or
Was he now really? Well, he wouldn't have. I don't think he would have allowed that maybe to stand in the way if things got very. But he went away to America and formed the Irish National Guard. Did an enormous amount of work over there. But he was very hot-headed.
Yeah, but Frank, I must say that it's interesting that you took the political route, and that's something that you thought that you would actually achieve more probably by doing that. Because
I suppose as well as that, I didn't think that there was that they would win anywhere, you know. And there were no... I got to know quite a number of them, a lot of them. And I would have met the top guys on a number of occasions to try to talk a bit of sense into them and say... Particularly when Stormont was abolished, prorogued in 70... When was that? 72. We went to the leadership of the IRA. We sought an audience.
And did you get a...
Oh, we did. We got an audience. But sure, we met as we've been talking to the wall. We said, now's your chance. You have achieved what this is an amazing achievement. Why don't you,
put down your gun?
And why don't you take credit for it and go the political route? Oh. Absolutely, completely turned down flat.
This is
the long war, and we are going to win it.
Was that the attitude?
That was the answer.
Were you involved in the peace negotiations leading up to the Good Friday Agreement?
No, I wasn't involved in politics at all then. Yeah. You see, I lost my seat in 1974. I fithered on at politics in 1977 or 1978, and then I packed it in.
But just what you told me is fascinating. How you, because of who you were, you were privy in knowing these people, and then you got the opportunity for them to try to talk to them, as you say.
Yeah.
So why didn't you persist?
But sure, when somebody tells you, well, of course I persisted. We kept on at it, but until I suppose Adams and those guys came along, there was just nobody that would even contemplate that. The man that we met on that occasion was McStephen was gone, but Seamus Toomey was the allegedly the chief of staff, the boss man, but sure, he dismissed us. And we were brought on a very circuitous journey in Dublin to make sure that we weren't followed by the special branch and that he wasn't going to be nabbed. But eventually we met this man in a room, and the faintest idea where it was, nor would I want to know. There was two or three of us, and he had somebody else with him that was never introduced. I don't know who the hell was the other boy was. I've never seen him before or since.
Oh, was he from Northern Ireland?
No, he was from the south.
Yeah.
Seamus Toomey was from Belfast, of course.
Yeah.
But the conversation lasted a very short period of time, and the answer was... Politics is a dirt, not at all. Politics useless. All politicians are the same, and we're in charge now, and we're fighting the long war, and we're going to win.
So, can you recall the year that happened?
That was the year that Stormont was.
Yes, in the 1980s. Then.
No. That was Stormont after Bloody Sunday. Short time after Bloody Sunday.
Oh, it was very Stormont. Early on.
Stormont was abolished. Stormont was abolished, and England took direct rule. Now, and I should know the exact date of that, but I can't. I can't tell you right now.
Right, but it was early.
That's one of the things that happens when, like Father McKernan, there you get on a bit in years. Yeah. dates become a problem.
The next time we meet,
72.
Yeah.
It was 70. I'm quite sure it was 72. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but there was a definite determination to continue.
It was a seminal moment that where they could have said, okay, we have got so much.
Having a seat in Parliament, I mean, that must have been quite an experience.
It was. It was. When I was asked, I always said, well, what do you think of Parliament? I said, it's a fine place for Englishmen, but not much of a place for Irishmen. And most people were polite to me, but they paid no attention to you at all. Absolutely none. You might as well be idle, you know. I went to see Reginald Maudling, who was the Home Secretary, very shortly after I was elected. And the big campaign of the civil rights movement in Fermanagh was the abolition of the county council, which was a complete and total abomination. A unionist majority council in a county that had a nationalist majority. So, I mean, you can figure out how that was achieved. So I eventually seen Maudling anyway. He was the fellow that Bernadette scrapped. And I said, I want you to. I made the case, and I said, are you going to abolish the. Convincing case, and will you consider abolishing the Fermanagh County Council? And he said, no, I won't. And I said, can I ask you why? You can't. He says, but I'm not obliged to tell you. He says, young man, he says, you must understand that Parliament. The British government is an elected dictatorship, and for so long as we have the confidence of the House of Commons, we can do whatever we like. So, in other words, you know, sling your hook, get lost. No, go away.
So that
was
you weren't getting anywhere.
No, you weren't getting anywhere. Nor was anybody else. No, I was there. Jerry Fitt was there, and Bernadette. There was three of us.
But there was a time. I'm sure you know these were times that you had the Bobby Sands.
But that was later.
That was much later.
That was much
okay,
later.
But in those 70s, you had bombing and shooting.
Oh yeah,
yeah. But surely they were looking at you as being.
Oh, part and parcel.
Part and parcel of all of that.
But so that's why that later on, that's why your man Hogg, Douglas Hogg, who was the son of the Lord Chancellor, if you don't mind, who said that certain solicitors in Northern Ireland were, terrorists. And a few days later, Pat Finucane was shot. And we all got a warning from the police that, look out, your name's probably on a list. You know, that you're a marked man because we were defending Republicans, who were charged with very serious offences, and therefore we were guilty by association. You know, defending these awful people?
And did you actually ever get a threatening letter in the post?
Oh, dozens of them. Unfortunately, the Public Record Office wrote to me very early on, would it be good enough to keep all these things, you know? But my wife wouldn't have them about the place, you know?
Yeah.
And the day, a couple of days before I was shot, we will get you, there was a man called Lily, who was a UDR man, had been killed a few days before that, and it came in on a chocolate box, you know, a piece of piece of cardboard torn from a chocolate box. We will get you for Lily, and that was put through the letterbox, posted, and it turned out to be the real McCoy. But abusive phone calls and threatening letters I used to be away an awful lot. My wife was a teacher, and one Saturday we had nothing to do. And we lived upstairs at the top of, three or four flights of stairs. So I decided that, like a good husband, I would go down and I would make the breakfast and I would bring it up and to bed. And I did that. And I brought the post up with me, unfortunately, because there was a very large amount of post. And we were, after breakfast, I was sitting opening this post. And the next thing that fell out was a big bullet, a huge bullet gun. So it didn't help the breakfast very much. and it you know, along with it came a letter, the next one has your name on it, the usual old stuff, you know. So I had to take this bullet to the police and say, look, you better get rid of that now. It was sent to me
in an envelope,
and they tell me the next one will not come in an envelope, you know. So,
wow.
And caramel, it would have kind of cordial your cornflakes a wee bit, a thing like that, you know. So,
But your poor wife, I mean,
oh,
she took all that very, very ill
because she was static. She was sitting at home when I was wandering about the place, you know, free in Ireland. And she was sitting at home worrying about would I ever come back. And once we were at the cinema. We used to go to the cinema very much while we were going out together. We loved going to the cinema. And I got a tap on the shoulder from the cinema owner. He says, oh, there's trouble in Clogher. You better go down to Clogher. There's a whole lot of people surrounded by the army down there. So I had to leave the pictures. And I went to Clogher, to the border, where they were trying to open a border road again, you see, and the army had completely surrounded them. And I went there as the local MP to try and help, and I ended up getting arrested, like the whole lot of them. We were all thrown into a lorry and brought into Clogher Police Station. And my sister, my oldest sister, who's 90 now and in the hospital at the moment, still living in the home, in the place where I was born and reared, she heard this on the news. She was working in an hotel in London in the night shift. That the MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone had been arrested. And what did she do? Only ring Carmel and waken her up to tell her that I had been arrested, which didn't help greatly. And if she'd thought for a wee minute, she'd say, well, no, we'll wait till the morning now to do that. But she got very excited. We went into Clogher on that occasion, and I remember it so very well. The police didn't know what the hell to do with us. Clogher's a small police station.
Yes.
So they put us all into the day room, or whatever you call it. And there was 30 or 40 of us. And the one boy started looking in the drawers. And he came across a book, an instruction manual for firearms. Jeez, he says, that might come in handy. And he put it in the pocket, took it away with him. We were all released without charge. And they were quite a big book, and he stuck it in his pocket anyway and took it away with him. I don't know whether he was kidding or not, but
these anecdotes could go on all day.
Some of them are funny and some of them not so very funny,
but they really do tell you about the past and about that those years. Would you call them violence?
I mean, 72 was a dreadful year. I mean, 72 was an absolutely awful year.
Yeah.
Jeepers, people were getting killed. Right? I mean, there wasn't a day that you put on the radio but there was somebody else killed, you know, on either side. It was ferocious, because internment came in 1971, on the 9th of August, 1971, and I was married on the 11th of August, 2 days later. Which meant that I never got a honeymoon, because you couldn't just walk. But the whole place was going up in bloody flames. I mean, it was atrocious, and it went on from there. And then 72 became a more desperate year altogether. You know, terrible.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, these stories, they need to be told. They need to be recorded. Mm-hmm. And so, Frank, no, I know I'm run out of time. So is it okay if I come back to you again?
Oh, sure.
I need to come back. I'll go over this and mull over this and come up with some interesting questions. Okay, thanks, Frank.
Not at all.
Frank Mac.